Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When the going was good, you couldn't get closer to rock star status in business than Carly Fiorina came. Her up-by-the-bootstrap story, from bright-eyed receptionist to chairman and CEO of Hewlett-Packard, was a cover story all over the country. A hard-charging woman at the very top of Silicon Valley's legendary printer and computer company, HP, the most powerful businesswoman in America. There is no glass ceiling, Fiorina famously said as she took the reins. In 2005, she was sacked. Now HP is engulfed in a spying scandal, and Carly Fiorina is out with a memoir the Wall Street Journal calls backstabbing. Up next on Point, Carly Fiorina, the once most powerful businesswoman in America, tells her own story right here. Joining me now from New York is Carly Fiorina. She's former CEO and chairman of Hewlett-Packard, which she led for almost 6 years. She worked her way up at AT&T and Lucent Technologies. In 1998, Fortune magazine named her the most powerful woman in business. In 2005, on the eve of her firing, Fortune's headline was, "Why Carly's Big Bet is Failing." She's out now with a new and highly anticipated memoir called Tough Choices. Carly Fiorina, it's great to have you. Welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
You wrote this yourself. CEOs don't normally do that. What was that like?
Well, I actually enjoyed writing it very much. I had been thinking about writing a book for several years, and I knew if I did it that I would want to write it myself because I wanted to write an authentic book, and for me that meant it had to be my voice and my feelings and my experiences.
So there it is, and we've got it straight from you, going all the way back to your childhood, through your experiences coming up through the corporate ranks. Take us back, if you would, to that first job. You dropped out of law school when you realized it wasn't for you, and suddenly you're sitting at least part of the time answering phones and being kind of a receptionist just blocks from Hewlett-Packard, which you would ultimately lead. What was that first job? How did you feel about it?
Well, I wasn't sort of a receptionist. I was a receptionist.
Okay.
I had graduated from college with a degree in medieval history and philosophy, if you can believe it, and I wasn't employable. But I knew how to type and I knew how to answer phones, and frankly, I was most focused on paying the bills. And so I took that job. I actually took the job very seriously. I worked hard at it. And after doing that job for several months, two men in the office said, you know, maybe you could do something more. And they asked me to help them write up deals. That really was my first introduction to business. And it's formed the foundation of career advice I've given ever since, which is whatever job you have, learn everything you can from it, do the best job you can at that job, and opportunity will knock.
You fought your way up, climbed your way up to enormous success, a whole lot of money, very big business doings, ultimately a sacking. There's a lot we want to talk about in this hour, but when we think about the Carly Fiorina story, how do you see it? Should we look at it as a gender story, a leadership story, both? How important is the gender piece here?
Well, you know, the real answer to that is that I am a woman. I don't know what it's like to be a man. I've had tremendous success as a woman. Many, many men have taken a chance on me throughout my career, and it's still different for a woman than it is for a man. We still don't have enough women in positions of authority and responsibility. And I was leading a very large transformation of a very historic company, and a fair amount of criticism and even perhaps some hostility would have come my way in any event.
In the end, the Compaq merger, which you pushed through over a lot of opposition and a lot of controversy, and I guess the tail end of that came back and bit you. The board said, thanks, but no thanks, Carly, and bid you adieu. You opened the book with that, the February 2005 sacking of Carly Fiorina. I wish you'd read some of that for us, Carla Fiorina, if you would. It takes us so intimately into a situation that most people will never face, and there you were right in the middle of it. Could you set up, this is right in the prologue, set it up and give us a read, if you would.
Of course, I will. In the end, the board did not have the courage to face me. They did not thank me, and they did not say goodbye. They did not explain their decision or their reasoning. They did not seek my opinion or my involvement in any aspect of the transition. Having asked me to come to Chicago for a meeting, they left me waiting in my hotel room for more than 3 hours. As I waited, I knew whatever came next would be a turning point. After I finally received the call to rejoin the meeting, I thought about each board member as I rode the elevator down past those 24 floors. I didn't know what to expect, but I assumed I would be facing them. I wasn't prepared for the empty conference room I entered. Only the two designated messengers and a lawyer remained in the room. The chair of the Nominating and Governance Committee said, "Carly, the board has decided to make a change at the top. I'm very sorry." I knew he had opposed my ouster. And then the new chairman said they wanted my help in positioning the news. She said they thought I should describe this as my decision. I should say I thought it was time to move on. I asked when they wanted to make the announcement. Right away. The meeting lasted less than 3 minutes. I asked for a few hours to think, and I left the room. I believe the truth is always the best answer, whatever the consequences. Less than 2 hours later, I sent a message to the new chairman saying we should tell the truth. The board had fired me. When the announcement was made, I simply said, "While I regret that the board and I had differences over the execution of the strategy, I respect their decision. HP is a great company, and I wish the people of HP all the best." I had always known I might lose my job. I was playing a high-stakes game with powerful people and powerful interests, but I had not expected the end to come in this way. I knew we were on the verge of reaping tremendous benefits from all our hard work, and I thought the board knew this too. I wanted so much to be able to gather my team one last time and tell them how proud I was of all we had accomplished together. My heart ached that I was not given an opportunity to say goodbye to the people of HP, whom I had grown to love. I knew the announcement would be big news. I was a woman, and a bold one at that, and things had always been different for me. All the criticisms that had ever been leveled against me would be recycled and thrown back in my face with new delight. She's too flashy. She's just marketing fluff. She's too controlling. She's a publicity hound. The merger was her idea, and it was the wrong thing to do. She's imperious, vindictive, and employees didn't like her. The coverage would go on and on, and the critiques would not be balanced against the facts or my contributions or the positive changes that had been made. It would be ugly, and it would be personal.
Carly Fiorina, former chairman and CEO of Hewlett-Packard, HP, reading there from the very first paragraphs of her new memoir, Tough Choices. You go straight at it, no holds barred. We should point out that one of those waiting for you in that room was Patricia Dunn, who now herself is out as chairman of HP, and the whole scandal over leaks and spying on those leaks. There's been a wide range of receptions for your memoir, Ms. Fiorina. I'm looking here at the Wall Street Journal, a couple of tough ones. Alan Murray says that you and Patricia Dunn have both portrayed yourselves as victims, and you are to some extent, but you've also overplayed the part and done no favor for the sisterhood, he says there. The review by George Anders today says, you know, it's backstabbing, grudge-holding, rival-bashing, really snarky. What do you say to that end of the reception that your books received?
Well, you know, one of the things I knew when I chose to write an authentic book is that it would be controversial. And it would be controversial because if you write an authentic book about things as they actually happened, you're going to talk about some good things and some bad things. The truth is, this book is filled with people who have done wonderful things for me. And the book also has some examples of people who acted in a way that I didn't particularly admire. That is life. For better or for worse, I'm a person who believes in plain talk. It gets me into trouble sometimes. But this book is plain talk about my experiences, my life, and how people really are. One of the lessons I've learned in my life is that people are people, wherever you find them. When I was a secretary chatting in the mailroom or a CEO chatting in the boardroom, some people act in a way that makes you proud and some don't.
HP wasn't hitting the numbers when the board booted you up, but now it's just going gangbusters. Mark Hurd is the CEO now, of course. How much credit do you think you deserve, any, some, a lot, for Hewlett-Packard's current kind of fat city status? It's doing great.
Well, actually, Hewlett-Packard made a lot of numbers when I was there, just to be factually correct. And we missed a couple quarters, but we were also in the middle of a massive transformation of a tradition-bound company. Hewlett-Packard was lagging further and further behind, and we needed to do the heavy lifting of change. Part of that heavy lifting was the merger with Compaq. It was hugely controversial, no doubt, but it was also a unanimous decision of the board, and it is now virtually unanimously acclaimed as both a success and the foundation for the current success of Hewlett-Packard. In the end, this isn't about me versus Mark or who deserves more credit, but it is about the fact that a transformation of a company takes a long time, and the work that I did, the heavy lifting work that I did, is part of the foundation of the company's current success.
Carla Fiorina, I wish you'd take us back to this remarkable moment when you have moved from receptionist out a couple blocks from HP to AT&T. And your bosses there are dealing with a big contract with the, what is it, Bureau of Indian Affairs, and take you out to lunch at a strip club. It's a remarkable story. Share that with us.
Well, this was my very first job in AT&T. I was a brand new sales rep, and I was sharing a account with a colleague, and we were meeting very important clients. And the day before the meeting, he came to me and said, "You know, Carly, I know you want to meet these clients, but you can't come with us because we're going to eat lunch where the clients want. And that's a strip club, ironically called the Boardroom."
So these were officials in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And when they wanted to do business with AT&T, they wanted to do it at a fancy strip club.
Well, lots of men wanted to do business in fancy strip clubs back then, not just the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Okay, I mean, fine, I'm sure it goes on even now, but it's kind of, I'm sure, news to some people to think of government officials, you know, negotiating contracts while half-naked girls dance around them.
Well, we actually weren't negotiating contracts. We were making acquaintances. And frankly, I'm not sure it was even the official's idea. It may have been my colleague's idea.
Okay.
Because I think his purpose in taking me to a strip club was either to prevent me coming to the meeting or perhaps, if I showed up, which I chose to either embarrass me or intimidate me. I ended up going to that meeting. You know, I
describe the setting for us, the boardroom on Vermont
Avenue. The boardroom on Vermont Avenue. I don't know how many of your listeners will remember, but there used to be a book called How to Dress for Success for Women, and it encouraged young women like me to dress in very conservative suits and wear little bow ties at our throat. You know, so I'm dressed in that way, and I'm carrying my briefcase, and I go to the boardroom, and when I open the door, it's very dark. It's very noisy. There's a long bar down the right-hand side, and on the left, there's a large stage, and there are many young women dancing on that stage. And the only way that I can get to my colleagues is to cross that stage in my little suit and my little bow tie, clutching my briefcase like a shield of honor. And I have to make it all the way to that table and sit down. But I made it.
But they just went right on. I mean, they even invited the girls in the baby doll negligees over to the table with you.
They did. And you know what every single one of those young women said when they were invited over? They looked at the situation, they understood what was going on, and every one of them said, "Not till the lady leaves."
Now, what's interesting? Kind of gender solidarity right there. They weren't going to.
Well,
you know,
they could
see
what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I read it, a show of empathy. I will also tell you that not all men did business in that way, but because I stood up to this particular man, when I came back to the office, everything had changed. I had gained newfound respect from my colleagues, newfound respect from this particular man. And in fact, we went on to become great colleagues and great teammates. We never talked about that incident again, but he never again tried to exclude me. And in fact, he went out of his way to include me because he'd figured out I was going to stand up for myself, but he also figured out I had value to add.
Carly Fiorina is with us. Her new memoir is Tough Choices. She's made a bunch. Of course, others did too. A board sacked her and tossed her right out at HP. Of course, $21 million helped. Cedar Rapids, Iowa calling. Ed is on the line. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you see, Ed? What do you hear?
Well, the only reason I'm calling is I was really puzzled when you said that there's no such a thing as the glass ceiling. To whom more is given, more is required. It seems to me you would have said the same thing, like there is no racism in the world. So I am really not pleased. Obviously, you are an intelligent woman, but I'm not too happy about that statement. To me, I'm sorry to say, it is irresponsible to say.
There's a big story behind it, Ed, and let me ask Carly Fiorina to tell it. This, when you said the glass ceiling doesn't exist, put that in context. For what was the day? What was the moment? What were you thinking?
Well, first let me say to Ed that I appreciate you being so direct. I believe in plain talk, and you're absolutely right. It was a mistake to have said that. And let me read from the book to try and explain what I was thinking at that time.
This is the day that you were brought to Hewlett-Packard, sort of this was your unveiling as the new CEO.
Yes, and remember, just to put this in context, I was not only the first woman to lead a Fortune 20 company, but I was also the first outsider at HP. I wasn't an engineer. I didn't come from Silicon Valley. I didn't even come from the computing industry.
You weren't in the Hewlett family or the Packard family.
That's right. You were
from marketing.
So all of those things made me a very different kind of package. Now, reading from the book, I didn't want to talk about my gender or the glass ceiling. These topics were distractions from the mission at hand, and they separated me from the vast majority of my employees. And so I was unprepared and impatient with all of these questions. When I said the glass ceiling doesn't exist, it made headlines. I was trying to change the subject. I was trying to say that women could do anything men could do. I was trying to tell women that although there are plenty of obstacles and prejudices, there isn't some invisible barrier that prevents them from achieving their dreams. I was reflecting my own experience that more is achieved by focusing on the possibilities than by fixating on the limitations or the inequities. I didn't succeed in conveying any of this. And from the first day on, I could not escape the categorization of Carly Fiorina, female CEO. Nor would I ever escape the relentless attention of the media. I never wanted to draw attention to myself, but once it was focused on me, I wanted to deflect attention to the company. Whenever I agreed to an interview, I'd set ground rules. I won't talk about the glass ceiling. I won't talk about myself. I'll only talk about the company. Over the years that followed, I turned down numerous requests from Glamour, People, Vogue, Diane Sawyer, Oprah Winfrey, and more. These were great venues and personalities, but they weren't interested in the company. They were interested in me. From my first until my last day at HP, I was criticized both for being in the press too much and for being unavailable to the press. From the first stories of my hiring until the last of my firing, both the language and the intensity of the coverage were different for me than for any other CEO. It was more personal, with much commentary about my personality and my physical appearance, my dress, my hair, or my shoes. That first week, the editor of Business Week came to see me with the beat reporter because they'd been working on a story for several months. Hewlett-Packard was going to be the cover story whether we liked it or not, and everyone recommended that I talk with them. Before we'd even sat down, the very first question from the editor was, "Is that an Armani suit you're wearing?"
Carly Fiorina, reading from her new memoir, Tough Choices. Ed, there's the context. Take it or not, Carly Fiorina, so what about it? The glass ceiling, 2005. Is it there? Does it exist? What's it look like?
You know, here's what I believe based on my whole life's experience. It is still different for women and people of color. The workplace is not gender blind or color blind, and it will be better, would be better, if it were both gender blind and color blind, because then it would mean we have achieved a true meritocracy in business. And yet, I also became a CEO. I know how many men took a chance on me. So is it different? Yes. Do we resort to stereotypes frequently about women and people of color because we don't have enough examples of them in positions of authority and responsibility? Certainly. I believe change takes both realism and optimism. Realistically, things are still different for women and people of color. Realistically, we don't yet have a gender-blind and color-blind work environment. But optimistically, I know it is possible to focus on performance, achieve results, and move ahead.
Ed, there's the story. Carly, from Carly Fiorina. Let's get another call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stephen is on the line. Hi, Stephen, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I've been an engineer for the past 25 years, and I've just always heard about HP. I just wanted to let your listeners know that you weren't kidding about it being legend and story. I've always thought of it as an engineer's, very much as an engineer's company. And wow, I certainly admire Ms. Fiorina for managing to make it to the and be successful in the leadership. So that's it. Thanks.
A thumbs up from an engineer in Cambridge. Let's get another voice, if we may. Carly Fiorina, we've got also joining us for a few minutes here, Michael Beer. He's Professor Emeritus of the Business School of Business Administration at Harvard Business School, Chairman of TruePoint, a consultancy, co-founded author of The Critical Path to Corporate Renewal, co-editor of Breaking the Code of Change. Michael Beer, Professor Beer, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
We're fine. Feeling a little awkward bringing on a man as a kind of judge here in the middle of this conversation. But nevertheless, you've watched business for a long time. You watched Carly Fiorina's story. She makes a very persuasive case. I mean, you know, this woman can make her way around ideas and no doubt around a boardroom as well. What do you think of her tenure at Hewlett-Packard, how she was for that company, and her taking credit for the sort of comeback that Hewlett-Packard has seen? She says was in no small part engineered under her leadership.
Well, first of all, let me say that running a large company like HP is difficult, and I admire Carly for taking that on. However, I personally do not share her views about her success at HP. I think this is a story. This is not a gender story, although there may be issues of gender at the board, and I wasn't there. I think this is a story of strategy, culture, structure, false assumptions about acquisitions, and about a change process that was far too fast and under-involving people.
HP's doing pretty great today. Does Carly Fiorina not deserve some credit for doing the infrastructure work?
It's very hard for me to parse that out. I believe, however, that in many ways, Ms. Fiorina set the company back by destroying it, what I think was historically successful culture, just as the former caller who's an engineer talked about it, because she made some false assumptions, as, by the way, the board did. The board hired her.
Such as?
First of all, let me say what Carly, what Ms. Fiorina got right. She got right the idea that the strategy needed to be a solutions-based strategy. IBM had demonstrated the path there. HP had to compete. But she did not follow through effectively in implementing that strategy. HP did have a divisional structure that made it difficult for general managers and division heads and various parts of the company to communicate well. The structure was a problem. She tried to create a front-back structure, which I think in theory is the right structure, but she chose the absolute wrong way to approach the change process and then did many things to interfere with it. An organization that's going to be solution-based has to be networked. It has to rely on relationships and caring of people for each other. She took, and the culture of HP basically supported that. That's one of the reasons why it was a great company for 5 to 6 decades.
Michael Beer, hold the thought there. Carly Fiorina, all right, here you are. You're no stranger to this. You've played in the big leagues. This is Harvard Business School critique, the tough stuff. How do you hear this critique? How do you respond to it?
Well, first of all, Michael, it's great to be chatting with you today.
Nice to talk to
you. One of the things I think some people forget, you're absolutely right, Hewlett-Packard was a great company. But by 1999, Hewlett-Packard was falling further and further behind. In the middle of the biggest tech upturn in history, Hewlett-Packard had missed 9 quarters in a row, and yet employees were receiving record bonuses. A storied technology company, Hewlett-Packard was no longer even in the top 25 innovators in the world. They had stopped innovating. So this was a company that once had been a leader, but now had become a laggard. Under those circumstances, important transformation is required. And the first and most fundamental decision we made, we meaning me, the board, the management team, and the employees of the company, was that the only goal that was worthy of the legacy of this great company was to lead once again and to lead in the 21st century.
Michael Beer
that
suggests
decision that, sorry, just to complete the thought, that decision to be a leader had several components. First, it absolutely called for greater scope and scale, hence the merger with Compaq. Secondly, we had to go back to innovation. By the time I left, we were generating 11 patents a day, 2 years running, and we were the number three innovator in the world.
Michael Beer suggests, and the Wall Street Journal is saying today, that there was a strategy there, yes, and he's saying thumbs up. The Wall Street Journal, though, says you became a leader without followers. Do you see any truth in that? And if so, why?
Certainly, I don't see any. I don't see truth in it. In this sense, you cannot pull off the most complex, largest merger in the history of the industry, which is what the Compaq merger was, unless you have a lot of followers. Integrating two companies, which everyone acknowledges was successfully done, and integration that provided a solid foundation for HP today, the integration of those two companies took tens upon tens of thousands of HP people all marching in the same direction. However, it is also true that when you are undertaking a massive transformation of a company, you have to do a lot of tough stuff. I laid off 30-plus thousand people in the course of my tenure. Is that difficult? Of course. Is it painful? Of course. Does it create hostility? Do some people not like me because they lost their job? Of course. But sometimes you have to make some people very, very unhappy, and I empathize with them
Michael Beer,
in order to save a bigger purpose.
We hear it. Michael Beer, last word in this segment goes to you. Gender, a factor here, a significant factor or not?
I don't believe it's a significant factor. I really believe the significant factors are the choices that she made, including the acquisition of Compaq.
Judy's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had to call when I heard your story about the strip club because I was in the same situation once back in the early 80s.
What is it with business and strip clubs, Judy?
I'll tell you, it was really one of those moments that was a turning point in terms of my acceptance in the group because I found I pretty much did a similar thing. It was a sales meeting, and they had gone out to dinner, and then they were going to go to this club after dinner. And I knew if I didn't go, I was going to be sort of on the outside still.
But were you humiliated or somehow put in your place by going? You know what I mean?
No, because what I decided was, okay, it's nothing I haven't seen before. You know, I'm a woman. I know the parts. You know?
Right.
And so I went, and they got at a table right next to the stage. I sat with my back next to the stage.
Yeah.
So as they were watching these women, they were also looking at me and starting to feel very uncomfortable with what they created.
So you've been there. What does that leave you thinking, Judy, about Carly Fiorina's accomplishment, having sort of fought her way through that little trial by fire?
You know, I admire her that she has stayed in there and fought the battle as long as she did because I left. I left the corporate world probably 13 years ago, and I'm self-employed now as an artist, and I couldn't be happier. But I think that as a woman, she's right. It's not a meritocracy, and the world would be better if it was. And I think if you're smart and you're capable, you're more of a threat as a woman or black person or whatever.
Judy, thank you very much for your call. Carly Fiorina, what is your word to other women, young women out there? Come on in, the water's fine, or watch out, it's a strip club in here. What?
Well, you know, both. I could say it ain't pretty, but it can be done. But that wouldn't be quite everything that I believe. And first of all, Judy, thanks so much for your comments. You know, it's amazing how many women say, oh, I've been there, I've done that. And frankly, sometimes young women still come up to me and say they've just recently had a similar experience. Look, here's what I would say. Let's be realistic. Sometimes people do all kinds of things because they're resisting change. It is human nature to resist change. And when a new person who happens to be a woman interrupts an existing power structure that is virtually all male, you're going to get some resistance. It's also true that for every man who tried to put me in my place, there were three or four others who saw what I could do. And that's how I could go from secretary to CEO is a lot of men, because it was mostly men who had the positions of responsibility and authority, could see past my gender and see through to my substance and my capabilities. And that's why I am optimistic. Business is all about results in the end. Are people people? Can people forget that it actually should be about results and lapse back into old habits and think it's about something else? Sure. But fundamentally, there's an opportunity in business to apply yourself to the production of results. So as I said earlier, I think I'm a realistic person, but I'm also optimistic that we can and will continue to make progress.
Talk to us about the circumstances of another woman, the one who met you in the boardroom that day that you were sacked, Patricia Dunn. Now she's out as chairman. She succeeded you there at Hewlett-Packard, and you've got a scandal over, first there were board leaks, and then this whole investigation that seems to have gone pretty far off the rails, criminal charges out there now, HP, pretexting, hiring people to snoop into board members' private phone records, into journalists' private phone records. That leakage began under your tenure. Were you involved in the investigation?
So, no. In fact, I myself was pretexted. And it's a strange feeling to look at a report and see your name and your personal phone number. So I know how
that is someone pretending to be you and by that getting all your phone records.
That's correct. So, look, I don't think my dismissal was about gender, in fact. Although the way it was handled perhaps had something to do with it, that's for others to say. What I think my dismissal had everything to do with was board dysfunction. And that's what I think the current scandal has everything to do with, board dysfunction. Dysfunction happens whether it's at the dinner table with a family or around the board table with a company. Dysfunction happens when people no longer can talk about the real issues in a straightforward way. And dysfunction happens when people's own personal insecurities or agendas or vendettas overwhelm a larger purpose, whether that is to build a family or to build a company. And that's what I think both my departure is about and the current scandal is about.
You describe your sacking as a kind of score settling in a vendetta. What vendetta?
No, I don't describe my firing that way. I think what I'm referring to, I think my firing apparently helped heal the wound between the company and the founding family's heirs.
That's what you mean by a score was settled.
Yes, exactly. I think perhaps with all the changes that were made, some people felt that the change agent who brought them about needed to be sacrificed. You know, I'm not going to play armchair psychologist here, but it wouldn't be the first time that history played out that way. But I guess what I would say about the current situation is, and, you know, I am reading about it and listening to it just like everybody else, so all I know is what's out there publicly. But I think setting aside the issue of whether pretexting is legal, clearly what happened here is a breakdown in straightforward communication between board members, and a breakdown as well in judgment and perspective and ethics.
Let me ask you, the columnist Alan Murray in the Wall Street Journal, I referenced this before, but it seems to get to this, to a gender issue, or at least he's putting it that way. The headline is Why Gender Plays a Role in HP Drama. And this, I don't know how you see this, if this is the boys' view, or, but he says that both you and Patricia Dunn have gone out in very public displays of righteous indignation. They both went down with guns blazing. He says, you know, that in positioning yourselves as victims, you're doing no favor to the sisterhood. Now, how do you hear that? Is that guy saying, look, gals, we don't play this way. We don't leave the boardroom and, you know, kiss and tell, and then say the board's dysfunctional. We just button our lip and march on. Is that the way things have traditionally been done? Are you breaking that? Is that a favor to the business world or not?
Well, first of all, I frankly think for a man to characterize me as a victim is ridiculous. I have never felt that I was a victim, not in this matter or anything else. And I think if people read the book, they will see that very clearly. Secondly, frankly, it always amuses me when men choose to talk about what helps or hurts the sisterhood. With all due respect, I don't think they have any idea. And to me, what's Alan Murray's column is Exhibit A. There are so few women still in positions of responsibility and authority that when we get a couple, we have to come up with some great pattern. You know, there have been lots of male chairmen and CEOs who were sacked at around the same time, and nobody felt the need to put them together and talk about why they were similar.
It was the toughest time ever for tech companies.
Absolutely. But I guess the other thing that I would say is plenty of people, plenty of men talk about other men all the time. And somehow the same adjectives don't apply, which is why I think Alan Murray's column is Exhibit A of all of the things I was saying about the media in the small excerpt that I read.
But then that world, I mean, you were the first Fortune 20 CEO. The ranks of the Fortune 500, women are still very rare. Look at boardrooms. There's a lot of that as well. Does that mean that that whole environment is so, is it toxic to women? Can you be a full-blooded woman and live in there, or is it just an atmosphere that's going to, I don't know, knock out an awful lot of females?
No, I don't think it's toxic. Yes, I do think women can survive and thrive, and I think I'm an example of that, having started out as a receptionist. I'm heartened to see several female CEOs appointed since I left HP. I am disheartened to see many female vice presidents leave HP. In other words, progress is always two steps forward and one step back. But I do think that, to go all the way back to the strip club story, one thing is for certain: to make it in an environment where you are different, you have to be brave, you have to be strong, and you have to take as a given that you're going to take a lot of shots. That's just the way it is.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to talk with you. Ron's calling from North Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not going too far off topic, but I do have more of a strategy question to ask Ms. Fiorina.
Okay.
One that has puzzled me for a while. Prior to the Compaq merger, there were pretty deep negotiations with one of the large services firms. It might have been Price Waterhouse, and those negotiations seem to have broken down.
Right.
But it seemed like an attempt for HP to move more in the line of what IBM was doing and becoming a total solutions company. Once they broke down, that would seem like a 180-degree turn and going off strategy to merge with a product company like Compaq.
A computer maker.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, one that's more of the same, and that consumes so many of HP's financial and human capital resources as to move away from a solutions focus. I've always been curious why that decision was made.
Carla Fiorina.
Yeah. So one of the great companies in the Boston area that perhaps your caller knows well is a company called DEC Digital. And in the controversy around the merger, a lot of people forgot that Compaq had acquired DEC. DEC was, and is still as a part of HP, a great solutions company, high-end technology, and high-end services. And so, yes, Compaq was a maker of PCs, but they also had a lot of services personnel and a lot of very high-end technology solutions. And so, indeed, it was the merger with Compaq and all its assets that put us in a position to actually compete with IBM.
But was it a lurch going from a Pricewaterhouse acquisition consideration to a Compaq consideration? That's what Ron seems to suggest.
No, it wasn't a lurch. First of all, Ron is correct that it was PricewaterhouseCoopers. The negotiations with PricewaterhouseCoopers were leaked in an interesting prequel. Were leaked, and that, of course, created great consternation in the marketplace. But more importantly, I walked away from that deal at multiple prices all the way down. It was offered to me finally at $3 billion. I walked away because I didn't think we could hang on to the assets of PricewaterhouseCoopers, which were all people. And that had to do with a very particular partnership structure of that company. I won't go into the complexities, but suffice it to say the bottom line was we thought we would buy the company and lose all the people. However, it was important to Hewlett-Packard that we have a full line of technology solutions. Today, Hewlett-Packard is well on its way to beating Dell. In part, that is because of the assets we got from Compaq. It also is well on its way to beating IBM, and that has a lot to do with the assets we got from DEC.
Let me ask you about a couple other things. Our time grows short here. You've been a woman at very high in the Fortune 500 with the very big kind of compensation we're used to seeing these days. I don't know how much it was in total. I mean, something approaching $100 million for your time and your severance with HP.
Actually, that's not factually correct, but I grant you that executive compensation. My severance package was $21 million.
Right, and I thought I read that there was another 60 or 80 before that. Maybe I've got that
wrong.
A
lot of that was stock and options, which much of the options I lost when I was severed from HP. And, of course, stock only has value if it goes up.
Let us say tens of millions and a nice
parting
package. Absolutely.
It's a lot of money. Don't misunderstand
me. And the kind of mentality where, you know, when you were hired, you said, hey, why don't you also pay to ship my yacht across country? You know, there's a lot of conversation about this these days. Are CEOs paid too much when they come in, when they serve, when they leave? You've been there. You've done it. One of the few women to do it. How do you look at that question?
Well, first, I didn't ask the company to pay to ship my yacht across country. It was one of those, you know, little interesting fictions that I don't know where it came from.
Boy, like, it's out there
built
everywhere.
A pink marble bathroom. Well, it's not factually accurate.
Okay.
Your listeners should know that.
All right.
Look, executive compensation is obviously a hot topic because it's a lot of money. I think the most important thing here is that we be utterly transparent, utterly open about what executives get paid so that people can make some judgments, shareholders can make some judgments about what people are being paid and why.
But here we are, we're looking, it's transparent enough. We see the big numbers. Are they too big? Or is the risk, I mean, you got booted in the end. So is it fair to be paid that large when you're always at risk of being, you know, dumped right out?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think we also have to remember is this is America. And in America, we have something called market-based compensation, whether it's for, you know, sports stars or chief executives. Now, there are lots of inequities in that system. Teachers, for example, clearly aren't paid enough. And I wish that we had a lot of emotion around the fact that teachers should be paid more, as much emotion as we have over others being paid too much. Mm-hmm. But I do absolutely believe that in this regard, facts are our friends. And so what we did at Hewlett-Packard is to say, look, let's be totally open with shareholders. Let's even seek to get them to approve, which is what we did, our compensation formulas, our metrics for reward, so people can see what we're doing, approve it in some cases ahead of time, and make their judgments.
No apologies on the pay. Put it right out there, Carly Fiorina says. We've just got a couple of seconds here. Rumors that you want to get into public life now. You're, what, 52 or something years old? You got a lot of time here. Somebody said you want to be head of the World Bank. What do you want to do next?
Well, there were rumors about a year and a half ago that was a possibility. Look, I made a decision a year ago that I wasn't going to jump back into full-time work until after I had written this book. I may go back into business. I may go into public service. Poverty alleviation is an important issue to me. Community development.
It's a big
time
world
will
out
tell.
There. Carly, we're
I'm
out of that
I'm not making
time.
A decision yet.
Thanks for joining us. Carly Fiorina, Tough Choices. This is On Point.